All right. Welcome in, everyone. Diving right into it today with a case, well, a Supreme Court case, really, that I think just about every law student, especially those interested in bankruptcy, needs to know about.
Yeah.
MOAC, Mall Holdings v. Transform Holdco. It really digs into some big concepts in bankruptcy law jurisdiction, mootness. We'll get to all of that, but it's all wrapped up in this really interesting scenario, a big asset sale and a lease. Well, frankly, a lease that seems almost too good to be true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's definitely a case that kind of grabs your attention right off the bat. I mean, a 100-year lease at the Mall of America, no less, for just $10 a year.
You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
But it's not just about this crazy lease. It really, this case, I think, shows how important those appellate rights are and how they work or don't work sometimes, you know, especially in bankruptcy cases where things can move so fast.
Yeah, totally. And especially, I think, when you've got these big, valuable assets that are being bought and sold, leased and transferred, you really see those procedural rules coming into play in a big way.
So that's what we're going to unpack today. What are the key legal issues here? And what does this case really tell us about bankruptcy law in action, right? How it's applied, what to watch out for.
Sounds like a plan. Let's dive in.
Okay, so rewind for a minute, back to 2018. Sears, the retail giant, you know, files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Major shakeup. Part of this whole process, in 2019, a lot of their assets get sold off to a company called Transform Holdco.
Right, classic kind of restructuring move in bankruptcy situation. Sell off assets, try to, you know, satisfy creditors, keep some part of the business going if possible.
And that's where this lease comes in, right?
Yeah.
Sears had this long-term lease with MOAC, the owner of the Mall of America, for retail space.
Mm.
And the terms, well, as we said, they were unbelievable. 100 years, $10 a year. Talk about a sweet deal.
Yeah, you don't see that every day. So Transform, when they buy up Sears assets, they naturally, you know, they want to get their hands on this lease, right? Makes sense. It's a prime spot in a major mall. Huge potential value there.
But, and here's where the friction starts. Transform, their plan wasn't to run a Sears store there themselves. They wanted to assign the lease to a subsidiary, one of their own companies, and then have that subsidiary sublease the space to someone else.
Yeah, see, that's where things get a little tricky because from MOAC's perspective, the landlord, it's not just about, you know, getting that $10 rent check every year. It's about the bigger picture, the whole ecosystem of the mall.
Right, tenant mix. That's the term I've heard.
Exactly. You want the right mix of stores, restaurants, entertainment, all of that to attract shoppers, right? A big department store like Sears that draws in a certain kind of customer, right? You replace that with, who knows, a bunch of smaller, maybe less well-known subtenants, it could throw off that balance.
Yeah. So MOAC, they weren't thrilled about this subleasing plan. But it's not just a business decision, right? There's a legal angle here, too. They fronted this assignment based on a specific part of the bankruptcy code, right?
Yeah, exactly. Section 365B3. This section is all about what happens when you want to assign a lease, especially in a shopping center context. It lays out these requirements for what's called adequate assurance of future performance.
Adequate assurance. Sounds pretty vague. What does that actually mean?
It means the party taking over the lease, the assignee, has to show that they're going to live up to the terms of the lease, basically, and that they're not going to negatively impact the shopping center. So you're looking at things like, you know, are they financially stable? Do they have a good track record of operating similar businesses? And critically, will their presence in the mall, you know, mess with that tenant mix or the overall kind of balance and success of the shopping center?
So MOAC, their argument was essentially this subsidiary with the subleasing plan, they couldn't really give those assurances. It was too much of a wild card.
Right, exactly. They couldn't say, you know, oh yeah, this is going to be just like having Sears here, no problem. The whole nature of the occupancy was potentially changing.
But despite all this, the bankruptcy court, they sided with Transform. They approved the lease assignment. Must have been a blow for MOAC. What did they do next?
Well, not surprisingly, they appealed the decision, right? Took it to the next level, to the district court. They felt like the bankruptcy court got it wrong, that they didn't properly consider those adequate assurance requirements under Section 365B3.
Okay, so now we've got this appeal going, and this is where we see another section of the bankruptcy code come into play, kind of a curveball, you might say.
Yeah.
Section 363 meters.
Yeah, this is a big one, and it comes up a lot in bankruptcy appeals dealing with asset sales. What this section tries to do is make sure that bankruptcy sales and leases too are final. It wants to promote stability, encourage buyers to participate, knowing that they're not going to get stuck in years of litigation, right?
Right. So if a court approves the sale or lease of property in bankruptcy and the deal goes through, a buyer in good faith, they take possession, it's done, right?
Ideally, yes, but there's a catch, and that's where this idea of a stay comes in.
A stay? Huh. I've heard that term thrown around in legal context, but it always seems a bit, well, mysterious.
Yeah, I get that. In this context, a stay is basically like a pause button. It's a court order that says, hold on, stop everything while we figure this out. So in this case, if MOACE had gotten a stay from the court when they filed their appeal, the lease assignment to transform subsidiary, that wouldn't have gone through. It would have been on hold pending the outcome of the appeal.
Ah, I see. So it's like, you know, putting the whole transaction on ice while the legal battle plays out. Makes sense. But they didn't get that stay, did they?
Nope. They didn't, and that turned out to be a pretty critical misstep.
So no stay, the assignment goes through, Transform subsidiary has the lease. What happens to MOAC's appeal? Does it just kind of evaporate?
Well, that's exactly what Transform argued. They said, look, because of Section 363 Mater, because this lease assignment is a done deal, and because MOAC didn't get a stay, their appeal is moot. It's pointless. There's nothing the court can do now, even if they were to agree with MOAC on the substance of the case.
So it doesn't even matter if MOAC had a really strong case, legally, about those adequate assurance requirements. It's all about timing, about getting that stay.
Yeah, that's the harsh reality of it sometimes in these bankruptcy cases. And the district court, they agreed with Transform. They dismissed the appeal as moot. MOAC appeals again, this time to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And, well, they didn't get much further there either. Well,
what happened to the Second Circuit?
Second Circuit upheld the dismissal of MOAC's appeal, and their reasoning was even more significant. They said that Section 363 Meter, this provision about mootness and stays, wasn't just some procedural rule. They declared it was jurisdictional.
Jurisdictional. Okay, now that's a big word in the legal world. So for our listeners who might be, you know, just starting out in law school, what does that actually mean, jurisdictional? Why is it such a big deal?
Yeah, good point. Jurisdiction is all about power, right? It's about whether a court has the authority to even hear a case, to make a decision about it. So if a statute, a law, is considered jurisdictional, it means it defines those boundaries of the court's power.
So if the Second Circuit is saying Section 363 Meter is jurisdictional, are they saying that once a sale or lease is finalized in bankruptcy without a stay, the appellate courts, they just can't touch it, no matter what?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the implication. And that's a big deal, right? Because it potentially shuts down any review, any possibility of correcting an error, even a big one, by the bankruptcy court.
And I'm guessing that's why this case ultimately ended up at the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot at stake, not just for MOAC, but for how these kinds of appeals are handled in bankruptcy cases all over the country.
Exactly. This interpretation of Section 363 Meters by the Second Circuit, it had the potential to really change the landscape, to significantly limit the ability of parties to appeal bankruptcy court decisions, especially when it came to these asset sales and leases. So the Supreme Court stepped in to provide some clarity.
And they did, thankfully. Justice Jackson wrote the opinion, and it was unanimous, which is always kind of reassuring, right? Everyone on the court agreed on this one. What was their main takeaway?
Well, to put it simply, the Supreme Court said the Second Circuit got it wrong. Section 363 Meter, it's not jurisdictional. That was their big holding, their main point.
So not jurisdictional, does that mean it's just like meaningless? What does it do then?
No, it's definitely not meaningless. It's just not about the court's power to hear a case. The Supreme Court, they drew a distinction between what they called jurisdictional rules, which are about power, and remedial limits, which are about what a court can do, what kind of relief they can give, assuming they do have jurisdiction.
Okay, so Section 363 Meter, it's a remedial limit. What's the difference?
It means that, yes, the appellate courts, they can hear the appeal, but what they can actually do about it might be limited if the sale or lease has already gone through without a stay. In that case, it might be practically impossible or just too disruptive to unwind the whole thing, to give the asset back to the original party.
So the court can hear you out, but they might not be able to give you what you want, practically speaking.
Right.
It's like you win the battle, but maybe not the war.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And that's really the heart of Section 363 Meters. It's about promoting finality in these transactions. So buyers, they have some certainty. They know they can rely on the court's approval. And that encourages participation,
yeah.
Right? Makes the whole bankruptcy process smoother, more efficient.
Makes sense. So the Supreme Court, they looked at this specific section, Section 363 Meters, and they said, nope, this isn't about jurisdiction. How did they get there? What was their reasoning? What were they looking at?
They took a multi-pronged approach. First, they looked at the actual text of the statute. Justice Jackson, she pointed out that the language itself, it doesn't explicitly talk about jurisdiction or a court's power to hear a case. It just says what happens if a sale or lease is reversed later on after it's already done. It doesn't say anything about whether a court can even hear that appeal in the first place.
Right. So the words themselves don't really support that jurisdictional reading.
Right.
What else did they consider?
Well, next they looked at the structure of the bankruptcy code, where this particular provision fits in the bigger picture. And they said, well, Section 363 meters is located in a part of the code that's all about how you use, sell, or lease property in bankruptcy. It's not in the parts that are specifically about jurisdiction, about which courts have power over what.
So context matters. It's not just about this one little section in isolation. It's about where it fits in the whole scheme of the law.
Exactly. And finally, they looked at their own past decisions, their precedents. They've said before, pretty consistently, that if Congress wants a law to be jurisdictional, they need to say so clearly, no ambiguity, no reading between the lines, and they just didn't find that clear statement in Section 363 meters.
So they said, Congress, if you meant this to be about jurisdiction, you got to be more explicit. I like that. Clear writing, clear laws, makes sense to me. But they also considered, or at least mentioned, Transform's arguments, right? Which were...
Right. Transform. Their arguments were interesting. They tried to argue that, you know, even if Section 363 meter wasn't explicitly jurisdictional, it still had that effect based on certain types of jurisdiction, specifically in REM jurisdiction.
In REM jurisdiction, just to clarify for everyone, that's about a court's power over a particular piece of property, right? Not just the people involved. So how did Transform tie that into this lease situation?
They basically argued that the bankruptcy court, by approving the sale of Sears assets, which included this lease, they were exercising this in REM jurisdiction over the lease itself. And because the lease was the thing at issue in MOAC's appeal, they said the appellate courts couldn't touch it, jurisdictionally speaking.
Clever argument, I'll give them that. But the Supreme Court wasn't swayed.
No, they weren't. They said in a nutshell that it wasn't enough. This in REN jurisdiction argument, it was too indirect, too far removed from the actual language of Section 363 meter. They also weren't convinced by Transform's historical arguments based on a prior bankruptcy rule, just didn't meet that high bar of clear congressional intent.
Okay, so big win for MOAC at the Supreme Court, right? They got the jurisdictional issue cleared up in their favor. You'd think that's the end of the story, but wasn't, was it? What happened next?
Yeah, this is where it gets, well, a little bit anticlimactic. So the Supreme Court, they reversed the Second Circuit's decision, right? Said they got the jurisdiction thing wrong, but they didn't just decide the case then and there. They send it back to the Second Circuit, what's called a remand.
So back down to the lower courts with this new guidance from the Supreme Court. What happened on round two?
Well, the Second Circuit, they acknowledged the Supreme Court's decision, of course. They said, okay, we do have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. But then they looked at everything else, all the facts of the case, and they came to the same conclusion. MOAC's appeal was still moot.
Still moot. But how? I thought the Supreme Court cleared that up, said they could hear the case.
They could hear it, yes. But the Second Circuit said there was nothing they could do about it, practically speaking. The lease, it was already gone. Transform's subsidiary, they had it. They were moving ahead with their plans. It was just too late.
So even with the right to appeal, even with the court acknowledging its power to hear the case, sometimes the timing just makes it impossible to get the outcome you're looking for. Ouch.
Yeah, exactly. It highlights how crucial those procedural steps are in bankruptcy, especially that stay pending appeal. If you don't get that stay, things can move so fast that by the time you get to the appeal, it's all over but the shouting.
Right. So it's a lesson not just about knowing the law, but about acting fast, strategically.
Absolutely. And for anyone involved in these types of transactions, leases, especially in a bankruptcy context, you got to be thinking about those procedural deadlines right from the start.
So what are the big takeaways here for our listeners, especially those future lawyers out there? What should they be thinking about after hearing this case?
Well, I think there are a few key things. First, that whole issue of the stay pending appeal. If you're challenging a sale or lease in bankruptcy, getting that stay, it's not just a formality, it's potentially the whole ballgame. Even if you have great legal arguments, if the transaction goes through before you get a stay, your appeal might just be moot. no matter how right you are on the law.
Yeah, that's a tough lesson. What else?
Well, I think this case also really shows how important it is for shopping center landlords, people like MOAs in this case, to know their rights, to understand those protections in Section 365B3, that whole adequate assurance requirement, and to act quickly to enforce those rights if they think a lease assignment is going to harm their interests, harm the shopping center.
Don't wait till it's too late.
Exactly. And finally, I think the Supreme Court's decision, it really highlights how they approach statutory interpretation, how they figure out what a law actually means. They look at the text, they look at the structure, where it fits in the whole code, and they look at their own precedents, what they've said before. It's a great example for law students of how these arguments work in practice at the highest level.
Yeah, it's not just about finding a law that seems helpful. It's about understanding how courts use those laws, how they interpret them. And speaking of interpretation, when we were talking about the Second Circuit's view of Section 363 meters as jurisdictional, it made me think, well, if the statute doesn't explicitly say jurisdictional, what might have been their reasoning for taking such a strong stance on that? Were there maybe some other underlying principles of bankruptcy law or some policy goals that they were trying to achieve with that interpretation? It's always interesting to think about those unwritten motivations.
Absolutely, yeah. You always have to think about the context, the bigger picture. Bankruptcy law, in a lot of ways, it's about balancing competing interests, right? On the one hand, you want these transactions to be final. You want buyers to feel confident so the bankruptcy process can work efficiently. But on the other hand, you want to make sure everyone's rights are protected, that there's fairness, that the courts can step in if there's a real problem.
Right. It's a balancing act. Not always easy to get it right.
Not at all.
So to wrap all this up, big picture, what have we learned from MOAC and Transform and this whole saga?
I think the main lesson is, even if you win on a key legal point like MOAC did the Supreme Court, that doesn't guarantee you'll get the outcome you want in the end. If you don't act fast enough, if you miss those procedural deadlines, the practical reality might be that it's just too late to undo what's already been done.
Right. Victory on appeal doesn't always mean victory in reality.
Precisely. And this case, I think, leaves us with a really interesting question to ponder. Knowing this, knowing how critical the timing is, what can lessors like MOAC do to protect themselves better in these situations, especially when you're dealing with a tricky lease assignment in bankruptcy? What strategies can they use to make sure their rights are considered, that their concerns about adequate assurance, about the impact on the shopping center, are taken seriously before it's too late?
Yeah, that's a great question for our listeners to chew on. Something for those future bankruptcy lawyers to think about. How do you navigate this system strategically to get the best possible outcome for your clients?
Definitely something to consider.
Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap up this deep dive. Thanks for joining us, and as always, keep those legal minds sharp.